Blog Talk Radio.
Today we're going to chat with our good friend Richard Baer, chief political correspondent at the American Thinker, and we're going to talk about the Iran nuclear deal, which is, of course, quite a controversial one. You may remember the story. It was never really approved by the Congress a couple of years ago. And it was basically it went into effect because the Congress didn't do anything about it. The Senate didn't do anything about it. And it kind of went de facto into effect, if that's a correct way of saying it. And now it's up for recertification. President Trump has decided not to recertify it and sent it back to Congress where it should have been in the first place. So that's where we are, and we're going to be looking at what happens now with our friend Richard Baer of the American Thinker. And I'm sure, Richard, let me say hello to you, because you're probably pretty happy that there's a Game 5 tonight.
Yeah, just keep extending the season. That works for me.
That's right. One more game, and, you know, the Yankees did that, and now they're at 3-2. So,
yeah. Yankees
so you never know.
I'm surprised.
You just never know what's going to happen when a team starts winning. But let me take you to another sport very quickly, the NFL.
Sure.
To me, the most interesting bit of information that I've heard, it's not just the drop in ratings overall, but the fact that fans – or at least this is what I understand. The fans are watching their home team. Like, I'm watching the Cowboys. You're probably watching the Bears. But they're not watching Monday night or Thursday night or the other games
true.
On Sunday. Which
yeah,
is, of
that's
course,
exactly
the whole, point of the NFL is that they have this menu of teams.
That's
but if you're only watching one, that doesn't do them any good, Richard.
Yeah, they've got Thursday, Sunday, and Monday night games now. And those are supposed to be national games, not like – the doubleheader games on Sunday, where they have, you know, six games in the early time slot and maybe three or four in the second one. And those games are basically assumed to be regional interest or local interest. The night games are supposedly national interest. The national games are way down. And to support that, there was a survey that showed that 57% of Americans had a favorable opinion of the NFL 3 months ago, and today 44% do. I mean, that's startling. I mean, the NFL was one of the very few things in America that you could say was kind of a unifying influence in the country. It was the only televised event that was among the top 10 for both whites and blacks, which is kind of interesting.
Right.
And every other program and the other 10 were different between whites and blacks. And now, in fact, that has become the issue. This has become, to some extent, a racial issue. And even though the issue supposedly is patriotism and the flag on one side and social justice and how police mistreat blacks on the other hand, a lot of which the data that some of these athletes are spouting is completely false. I mean, there were 16 African Americans unarmed who were killed by cops last year, 16 in the entire country, and half of them were killed by black cops. So, I mean, the idea that you got to be give a warning to your kids because otherwise they're going to be shot by a black cop as they walk down the street. I mean, that's absurd. But anyway, the issue is not playing well for the NFL. The NFL gains no fans because of this dispute, but loses some. And so this can't be a winner. Trump can get half the country to support him, and that's great. You know, that's probably better than his general approval numbers. The NFL at 50%, it's a disaster. I mean, they've lost fans.
Well, what I find fascinating is, and just to follow up on what you said before, the NFL or baseball or whatever the sport in season happens to be, was the one bit of small talk that Democrats and Republicans could actually enjoy.
Yeah.
I mean, I can remember many times going here to Telemundo to debate somebody. And the debate was very, you know, we didn't agree on anything. But yet before the debate, we were sitting there joking about the Cowboys or the Rangers. And it seems like the NFL is now no longer doing that. That we're not talking anymore about the Cowboys, you know, Elliot have a good day or Zach had a good day. We're now talking about issues that frankly I'd rather not be talking about. Let me ask you one another quick question before we get to the Iran nuclear deal. This is about a poll that came out. An organization named Morning Consulting, I think, is the name of the firm. I don't know much about them, but from what I've read, they're a reputable firm.
They are.
And they came out with a poll that said 46% of the people in the country, or the people in the poll, believe that the media fabricates stuff about Donald Trump or President Trump. That's half of the country, 46%. That's a pretty big number, Richard.
I mean, basically says most everybody who voted for Trump believes that to be true. And if you asked a similar question, which is if a story appears on Fox News and you asked it only of, you know, and you asked similar kind of survey, you'd probably find that 40 to 45% would say anything on Fox News is fake news. But there it would be all people on the left who would be saying that. So, I mean, the divide has become that people who are conservative believe one channel and not the others, and other people believe the other channels and not the one the first group does. And that's really not helpful. It means that you can't even, I mean, you cannot even find sources of information anymore that can be regarded as reliable by people across the political spectrum. In other words, if Alex Jones is saying something or some far lefty group is saying something, of course people are going to reject that. Mm-hmm. But when news media that were regarded historically as mainstream are now viewed basically as purveyors and inventors of fake news, I mean, that can't be good for a democracy.
No, but Richard, I mean, you're exactly right. I agree with you 100%. But every once in a while, there's a fast food place around here that I drop in and get a cup of coffee at between appointments or whatever, just to kill some time and prepare myself for the appointment. And they have that three-letter network, you know, the one with the three letters.
Right.
So I don't mention them. Well, let's say CNN. Okay, they have CNN on their screen there. Right. And you watch that for 30 minutes, and it's like, you know, you're sitting there saying, don't these people have something other to talk about than tell us how rotten Donald Trump is?
Yeah, and it's not only the stories they cover, but the ones they don't. For instance, there's certain parts of the media that are covering a story about the Clinton uranium scandal and Russian bribery and involvement of Mueller and Holder and Obama and Clinton dating back to 2009, 2010. You would not know that story exists if you only watch CNN, NBC, ABC, CBS, read the New York Times and the Washington Post. It's a non-story. It's not covered. And yet, on other networks, it's being covered from the kind of the top of the news hour. So, I mean, people are choosing what to cover, and then after they choose what to cover, they then report on it in a way that keeps their base of viewers, or what they perceive to be their base of viewers, happy. I mean, it's corrupt. It's really politically corrupt.
It really is, because, as you say, you know, how do you get any kind of sense that what you're getting is the truth? I mean, it is very difficult. Well, let's talk about the Iran nuclear deal. As I sort of said in the introduction, that a couple of years ago, this became the agreement went into effect, not because we did it the right way, but because I guess the Congress didn't vote for it. So it went into effect without congressional support. That I didn't know we could do that under our Constitution. But anyway, it went into effect.
Right.
And now it came back again, and President Trump did not recertify it. I'm just curious, Richard, before we get into the deal itself, where do presidents get authority to certify things? I cannot find that in the Constitution.
Yeah. I mean, it's an odd thing. Obviously, you are completely right that international agreements historically have been viewed as treaties, which required submission to the United States Senate and two-thirds approval. Two-thirds is a tough barrier. I mean, people complaining about 60-vote threshold, you know, to overcome filibusters and begin discussion of legislation in the Senate, two-thirds is a tough hurdle. Obama had no chance to get two-thirds approval for the Iran deal, and so he didn't take that route. Similar to the signing the Paris Agreement on climate change. He didn't submit that as a treaty either. I mean, other countries viewed it as such, and they brought them to their own to their own country's legislative bodies for approval. The U.S. didn't have that in either case. In fact, the only concession Obama was willing to make on the Iran nuclear deal was that the Senate could pass a resolution not approving it by a majority, but Obama could veto that. And if Obama vetoes it, then the Senate and the House would need two-thirds vote to override him. So in essence, what happened is instead of two-thirds required for approval, now you needed two-thirds to disapprove it. I mean,
right.
Talk about turning the Constitution on its head. I mean, that's what – and that was Obama's concession to make it look like he gained approval. And if you
right.
remember what happened when this was going on, the Democrats didn't even allow the Senate to have a vote on it. They refused to approve, even at 60 votes, the ability to discuss it on the floor of the Senate. I mean, that's how afraid they were of going on the record and
right.
and indicating support for this, because at some point we're going to go back to the pro-Israel community and they're going to seek campaign funds.
Well, and this is, I think, the you know, looking at it politically, this is why I think President Trump was smart in sending this mm-hmm. back to the Congress, because now he's forcing Democrats to vote one way or the other. Are they going to be with Obama? Or are they going to be with Israel? My sense is that they're probably
exactly
going to be with Israel when it's all said and done.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, one of the issues is that, you know, again, you talk about the few things in the country where there used to be some interest or support that crossed party lines. Supporting Israel historically has been that. It has been bipartisan. That's in part because of, you know, a very effective support by the pro-Israel community and lobbying efforts, but also because countries and members of the Senate and the House have viewed Israel as a nation similar to our own, and their constituents view that. And I mean, a large percentage of Americans are pro-Israel. So it was an easy vote to be pro-Israel. Now that has separated too. You have Republicans who are strong supporters of Israel, and Democrats increasingly are becoming sort of more lukewarm about it and
mm-hmm.
Sort of feeling the burn like Bernie Sanders supporters and looking for ways to separate from Israel
right.
and be more pro-Palestinian. So it's not a given anymore that on a tough vote, you're going to get Democratic senators. On an easy vote, say voting for foreign aid, then Democrats
right.
will line up with Republicans. Because anytime they're throwing money, you know, at something, that's easy. But if it requires a vote where you're potentially voting against, you know, the current president or the former president who's from your political party, Democrats couldn't do it. They wouldn't oppose Obama last time. They basically chose
right.
being loyal to Obama over the real issue involved about whether the Iran deal was a good deal or not. And my opinion, and most people who have looked at it seriously, it was not. It was one-sided, and Trump's absolutely right about it.
Yes, I think you're exactly right. Now, right now, it seems like it can go in one of two directions. It can be approved, I suppose, by the Senate as a treaty, or it can be approved by the House and then goes to the Senate and treat it as a treaty, which I think would give us a better deal at the end of the day. It would give us a better deal. Or it can fail completely, and there's no deal left. There's no agreement left. So how do you think this is going to go? Is this going to see – I mean, is the Iran deal a dead man walking, as they like to say? Or is there a possibility that maybe an even better deal can come out of the Congress? How do you see it, Richard?
Yeah. You're right that there's a lot of uncertainty about where this goes now. I mean, one thing is the Senate has a pretty busy calendar between now and the end of the year. They have – continuing resolutions that expire that keep the government running through the end of December. They have the debt ceiling, which also will be hit by the end of December. They're trying to get tax reform passed. They've got the DACA issue. They've got the payments to insurance companies, the CSR payments, which, you know, Trump has sort of gone back and forth on in the last week. So, I mean, these are all things there. And now suddenly you got this, which is not a simple matter. And in essence, what Trump has thrown back to the Senate is you have a chance to influence policy here. Okay? There's not going to be a new treaty because a new treaty would require Iran at this point to agree to it and sign it, because I don't think there's any chance that the Senate would approve the prior version of it. So if there's a new version, it requires an agreement. So what the Senate could do is they could say that the sanctions which were removed as a result of signing, of Obama signing the original agreement, that those sanctions are back in place if certain conditions are not met. And those are the conditions Trump's really been spelling out, which is that Iran is developing missile capability, that they are basically spreading weapons around the Middle East. They are an aggressor in Iraq and Lebanon and Yemen and Syria. They're spreading their wings because now they have a ton of money that was unfrozen funds that were released when this deal was signed, and they have sanctions relief from the international community, and they've got basically European and Asian businessmen flooding into the country to do deals, which they couldn't do for the last few years. So at this point, the United States can try to restore sanctions on its own, and depending on how they dealt with those sanctions, they could sanction European companies and Asian companies and basically force them to choose between doing business with Iran or doing business with the United States. That would be a tough action. Whether the Congress has the guts to do that, my guess, no. So I think, their first instinct will be to punt, but Trump is not going to let him get away with it that easily, because he's basically said, I'm going to give you a couple months to help steer policy. As you come up with nothing, then we'll walk away from the deal, because the deal is bad. It is not in America's interest. Mm-hmm. And if that happens, does the world collapse? Do we have, war with Iran? I mean, those are sort of catastrophic warnings mm-hmm. from people who were obsessively supportive of the deal and all in to back Obama on, anything he chose to do from morning till night for 8 years. At this point, the Iranians have given up much of their nuclear fuel. They don't have as many centrifuges running. They're not enriching uranium to the same degree as before. So even if the Iranians decided, okay, screw it, the deal's off, we're going to go now for a bomb, they wouldn't have one in 2 or 3 months. It would take them longer than that. And obviously there are countries then that might choose to take a different kind of action to prevent the program. But right now we know they are committed to developing a bomb. They never allowed IAEA inspections at the facility in Parchin, where apparently they're working on the trigger mechanisms. We know they're developing the missile capability. And if you think about what does it take to have a nuclear weapon, you need fuel. They still have centrifuges, so the question is just how long till they get enough fuel for the bombs. You need to have a trigger mechanism. Well, it's pretty clear they're working on it in a facility that they will not allow anyone to inspect because they say it's a military facility, therefore off limits. And we know they have missile capability. They're developing them. They're buying and selling them. So are they doing this because they want nuclear power for medical purposes? Which right. is what they were claiming for years.
Right.
That's
right.
What they want. I mean, right. This was regarded as, a serious nation making a serious claim when they did that. And, Benjamin Netanyahu came to the Congress to a joint session and ridiculed it, which was the only appropriate way to deal with it. And basically the Obama administration, treated him like dirt. They organized a boycott, 60 congressmen
yes.
show up for his talk, which is unheard of for a foreign leader. So, I mean, this was Obama's signature achievement, good, bad, or indifferent. And I think in this case it's bad. And so there's a big issue here. There are a lot of people who went to the mat to defend Obama because they defended Obama on everything. And Trump, is true to his message. He campaigned on something you can expect sometime down the road, whether it's 6 months, a year, he's going to get around to it and he's going to deal with it. And for what he said about the Iran deal, the idea that he had to keep certifying it every 3 months that the Iranians are in compliance when they clearly weren't, well, I give him credit for being honest about that.
Right. Well, it seems to me, Richard, if it's a bad deal, why stay in it? I mean, that's, I mean, we can try to improve it, I suppose.
That's exactly right.
I mean, my ideal conclusion to all of this would be to have it go to the Senate, have President Trump say to the Iranians, look, the deal before is over. We're not going to do that. But
right.
The Senate is willing to come up with a better plan from our point of view. And maybe this is a better deal for you as well. And then go and in a sense, have a treaty and go to Iran. And if Iran doesn't want to do it, well, the heck with them. But
yeah, no,
it's a horrible deal. And,
yeah.
You know, you said that when you first, I remember a couple of years ago when you came on the show, you said that. And it is a bad deal. So why continue to live with a bad deal, Richard?
Yeah. And the point is, Trump doesn't like every 3 months being forced to agree to something that he knows in his heart is wrong and in his gut is wrong. And, you know, why do some members of his own administration, you know, were encouraging him to try to stay in it? Because they got enough problems with North Korea and they got enough problems with other things going on in the world that they didn't want, you know, Iran to be on the full burner at the same time. I sort of understand that. But one of the things about some of these rogue countries is they're in it together. The idea that somehow Iran and North Korea are not cooperating on missile technology or development of a nuclear weapon is absurd. That's like saying the Khan network in Pakistan had nothing to do with the development of the bomb in North Korea. I mean, there are rogue nations, and they're considered rogue nations because of the way they behave. And so
that's right. That's exactly right, yeah.
And international law doesn't mean anything to them. Treaties don't mean anything to them. The Iranians are trying to argue that the deal is fine, they've done everything they're supposed to do, because they like the results so far. They've gotten $100 billion in cash, they got the end of sanctions, and they got businessmen from around the world flooding into the country, and they have the money to spread essentially the Shiite arc from Iran all the way to the Mediterranean. So they're sitting pretty, and they think this has gotten everything they wanted. What has it gotten for the United States? What has it gotten for our Sunni allies in the Gulf region, who see essentially an Iranian threat next door now, getting closer all the time because of aggressive actions by them and their proxies?
It's amazing, Richard. I think the lesson of the 8 years of the Obama presidency are not so much ideological, but they are constitutional, in the sense that if you follow the Constitution, he'd be in a much better place if he had followed the Constitution on this one in particular. He could have used, this is another thing, I never understood why he didn't use the treaty option as a way of getting a better deal by saying, look, guys, you know, I need a better deal because I'm going to have to get a treaty and I got to get 67 votes. It seems like he didn't even know how to negotiate, which is
it's completely right. And that's one of the reasons I think Trump was appalled by the whole process, because the administration wasn't looking for leverage. In fact, the Iranians looked at how obsessed the Americans were with getting a deal done, and they realized that they would concede every negotiating point that they brought up, that the Iranians brought up, which is what happened.
Right.
In the last 3-4 months of negotiations, we caved on everything. I mean, the final deal was much worse than the one that was on the table 3 to 4 months earlier. So this is what happens when someone's more concerned with their legacy and with being able to say that, well, Iran didn't develop a bomb on my watch, maybe the next one. And
right.
So, you know, I'm in the clear. And, you know,
right.
We didn't eliminate their ability to develop a nuclear weapon. There's not going to be a war on my watch either, because now that we have this deal, Israel's not going to attack them, and certainly we're not. So,
right,
no
that's
war.
Like the guy. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, so there's no war on his watch, and they don't complete a nuclear device on his watch, and that's all he's concerned with.
Yeah, well, he's like, you know, Obama is like the pitcher who walks the bases loaded and said, he hands the ball to the next guy and said, nobody scored on my watch. You know?
Right. That's a very good analogy. I like that.
So, really cool. Well, you can put that in one of your next blogs.
I like that a lot. That's great.
All right. Well, listen, Richard, I want to thank you again so much for giving us your time and sharing your thoughts with us. It's always a great pleasure. And you and everyone keep up the great work at American Thinker. And thank you for putting in a thing here and there. I'm always very proud when you publish one of my things, and keep up the great work. And by the way, that article about Cuba today was great. I thought that was great.
Perfect. Thanks so much. I enjoyed being on, Silvio.
No, in fact, I'm going to try to get a hold of that lady who wrote the review. I'm going to try to call Tom and see if he can put me in touch with that lady, because I'd love to talk to her. But I wanted to say one thing about that interview, but about that article, for those who read it, that in that article they mentioned Villa Marista, which is used to be the Catholic school in Havana where I went, and now that particular facility is a prison. Isn't that just all you can say about that regime?
Like the country.
That's right. Well, thank you, as always. Thank you for your time. It's always a great honor to have you.
Okay, Sylvia, have a great day.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. Again, our thanks to our friend Richard Baer, chief political correspondent at The American Thinker. Wanted to pass a say something here at the end, closing thoughts. There's all kinds of commotion. I was listening to talk radio this morning, all kinds of commotion about what President Bush, George W. Bush, said at a speech, I guess, in New York. And I happened to have heard the speech. I was not always able to hear these things during the morning, but today I was able to hear the speech. I don't know what the big deal is. He gave a very general speech about, you know, some pretty general things. I don't think he was criticizing anybody. You know, you could take a lot of what he said as a criticism of President Obama. I suppose you could take it as a criticism of President Trump. I don't really think it was meant that way at all. I think it was pretty much a former president talking about his ideals on a foreign policy and his belief in freedom and the importance of freedom. So I don't know what the big deal is. I certainly did not see the speech or hear the speech as anything other than President George W. Bush, I think, being a statesman and telling us how much he loves freedom and how much he loves the United States. So if anybody took it differently, I don't know why you did. I was listening to some people on the radio that were calling in saying, you know, Bush was part of the establishment. I don't know. I didn't hear it that way at all. I did not hear that in President Bush's speech whatsoever. What I heard was just a pretty simple speech about American, you know, about freedom and American ideals. And that's about all I heard. So, again, I didn't hear it. If you heard it, well, I didn't. That's all I can say. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas. Thank you for listening. Again, our thanks to Richard Baer. And we'll be talking to Barry Castleman here in the next day or two. We'll be talking a little bit about what's happening in Washington. Everybody have a good day, and we'll talk to you later.